introduced by Andrew McGregor.
The Berlin Philharmonic's back in town. Two proms, tonight and tomorrow, conducted by Sir Simon Rattle. And I know you'll have heard us talking about special atmospheres here in the Royal Albert Hall throughout the season, feelings of anticipation, etc., etc. It's all true, of course, but that sense of occasion is somehow intensified when the Berliners put in an appearance, and the queues around the block were enormous, I can tell you. It's the 12th time they visited the proms. The first was 37 years ago, during the winter prom season, in January 1973, when Herbert von Karajan made his only proms appearance with the orchestra, conducting two Beethoven symphonies, one of which begins this evening's concert. It's Beethoven's fourth symphony, and in the second part, they're playing Gustav Mahler's first. And why this particular pairing? Here's Simon Rattle.
We are starting a Mahler cycle this year. How unusual. I know every orchestra in the world is starting a Mahler cycle. But one of the things I wanted to do was put pieces that had either influenced Mahler or went into his world or are a direct result of Mahler. So Lachenmann and Mahler 9th, but Beethoven 4th and Mahler 1st, two symphonies that start basically even with the same introduction, that both come out of love affairs, that both come out of a feeling for the country rather than the city, and which are both absolutely imbued with a sense of nature and a feeling that the human spirit will conquer all, whether it is through humour or just sheer energy and love.
Simon Rattle, the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra's chief conductor and artistic director. And given his work with ensembles like the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment and the new generation of players that have joined the Berlin Philharmonic, I'd expect the Beethoven to sound quite different from the burnished, super-saturated Sheen Karajan and the orchestra produced back in the mid-70s. Well, the orchestra's led this evening by one of its first concertmasters, Daishin Kashimoto, who's tuning the orchestra at the moment. There are actually three of them to choose from, as well as a fourth, plain Concertmeister. And it's a considerably smaller orchestra than for the Mahler in the second half. Antiphonal violins, first and seconds on each side of the stage, 12 firsts, 10 seconds, 8 violas, 6 cellos, and 4 basses. And here he comes, Simon Rattle, to conduct them in Beethoven's four movement symphony number 4 in B flat, opus 60.
Thank you. Thank you.
Symphony No. 4 in B-flat by Ludwig van Beethoven, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Simon Rattle. A work they first performed here at the Royal Albert Hall under Herbert von Karajan back in 1973, when I'm told the Proms prospectus for the entire season's events cost a princely 20 pence. And the fourth is a symphony that seems to have suffered at the hands of its neighbours, the Eroica Symphony and that most famous fifth. Robert Schumann called the fourth a slender Grecian maiden between two Nordic giants. Back onto the platform comes Simon Rattle, stopping halfway, pointing out some of the principal wind players, bassoonist Daniele Damiano, and going and shaking the hands of the members of the orchestra responsible for some of that fabulous wind playing, particularly in the second movement. Oboist Albrecht Meyer, principal flautist Daniel Paud, and now the entire wind and brass section take a bow, followed by the strings, led by Daishin Kashimoto. Simon Rattle nodding his approval to all of them before bowing to the promenaders once again. And the quality of the string sound, especially when they're playing pianissimo, is outstanding, quite breathtaking. The Berlin Philharmonic's bringing us tonight the concert with which they launched their new season at home in Berlin's Philharmonie just last week, which reached a bigger audience than usual thanks to a live broadcast of the concert to over 60 cinemas all over Europe, from Austria and Belgium to Poland and Russia, too in the UK as well. And as well as free public viewings in Hamburg, Dresden and Cologne. If you think that's a big audience, wait till you've factored in the orchestra's other auditorium. It's Digital Concert Hall Online, which broadcasts 30 concerts a year and then archives them. Well, don't forget that this Radio 3 broadcast has its own online audience, as always. More over the next week using the iPlayer. And I hope you'll audition the new extra high-quality audio stream for the proms, which launched earlier this evening, an experiment from this Berlin prom to the last night. You'll find it alongside the normal streams on the prom's website, where on the front page you'll see a box marked high-quality listening. Do try it. Let us know what you think. It's an experiment, and I'm told that any feedback will be appreciated. Well, when the Berlin Philharmonic first visited the proms in the mid-70s, Beethoven was undoubtedly the most popular symphonist on record and in the concert hall. But these days he seems to be being usurped by a composer who's become central to our appreciation of Austro-German musical tradition. In the second half of this evening's Berlin Philharmonic prom, we're going to hear the work that introduces the symphonic world of Gustav Mahler, his first symphony, for which Sir Henry Wood himself was an early champion, giving the British premiere at the proms in 1903. First, though, we've more from the Proms Literary Festival, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music. Here's Anne McElvoy.
So hello and welcome to the Royal College of Music and this year's Proms Literary Festival. We're listening to Sir Simon Rattle conducting tonight, an honorary Berliner who's made his home at the Philharmonia in the heart of Berlin. In this literary prom, we'll be exploring the fascination the city's had over 20th century writers and artists. And joining me now is Philip Kerr. His Bernard Günther series of crime novels is set in Berlin, and they feature the city with all its grime and grandeur as a kind of character in its own right. We'll also be hearing some extracts from writing about Berlin from the actor Claire Higgins, and please welcome them both now. Now, Philip, you've got a long-held fascination with Berlin, as evidenced by the fact that you've set, I think, now your seventh novel there. Mm. What first attracted you to the city?
I suppose movies, actually, that I'd seen, books I'd read. The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, Cabaret with Liza Minnelli.
But it has had a fascination, hasn't it, in many incarnations for writers and artists, both German and from the outside?
Well, it's had so many incarnations. That's the interesting thing about Berlin. It's a kind of city of the 20th century, although a 20th century that starts in 1871 with the unification of Germany. And there are five separate periods, 1871 to 1918, the Hohenzollern period, the Weimar period that comes up to 1933, then the Nazis till 1945, then the Cold War, which is then followed by the second reunification. So two unifications sort of bookending possibly one of the most fascinating periods in history. So every time you sort of think you know everything about Berlin, you find out something new. It's constantly reinventing itself. Anyone who's been to Berlin will know what I'm talking about. It's just like one huge building site. And oddly enough, it's the same. It's the same thing that's happening now as happened in 1871 after Kaiser Wilhelm I decided this was going to be his capital city. There was a huge amount of building that went on and a huge amount of emigration that happened. And this is history is repeating itself. There are people moving in from the east now and new buildings going up all the time.
You mentioned the lure of what we might call Isherwood Berlin, cabaret, the Brecht period, and the accompanying whiff of sex and scandal, and the idea of Berlin as a place where all sorts of forbidden things were allowed. It has a terrific grasp on the imagination, even today, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. I think, in Isherwood's day, of course, I mean, Isherwood went because Auden had asked him, and Auden went, in reality, to suffer. This was a very important thing for Auden. And when he went in 1928, he thought it was important to be in a really poor area and to have intercourse with the working class. When he got there, he discovered that actually literal intercourse with the working class was incredibly easy. He actually wanted to meet rough German boys to have sex with. And immediately he was there. He thought, God, this is marvellous. And so Isherwood hot-footed out there, and so did Spender and many others. And of course, a number of factors had made Berlin cheap. There'd been, you know, the currency, the crash, the depression. It was jolly cheap to be a, a libertine. When the crash happened in 23, artists and writers sort of flocked to the place because you could live. I mean, Hemingway writes about an occasion when he goes there with like a sort of $100. And on his first day, he manages to get through 19 cents and has lived like a king for the entire day and describes, you know, this fantastic experience for a writer of actually, you know, living like a king and still having money left in your
pocket. And it being socially acceptable to be just creative but not earning a lot of money, because it's not a city that's obsessed perhaps by money in the way that Hamburg or Munich is.
Well, no, Berlin's always been a very left-wing city, which is another reason people have distrusted it. I mean, Hitler hated it because it was the most left-wing city in Germany.
But as we know from Weimar, the party had to stop and everything changed with the rise of the Nazis and the onset of war. And the first reading we're going to have is the American diplomat William Russell, who witnessed Berliners listening to Hitler on the radio following the declaration of war. Claire.
I stopped in front of a radio shop where a large crowd was collected on the sidewalk to listen to an outside loudspeaker. Martial music blared from the radio. The Germans talked happily amongst themselves. We waited for an hour, hearing the stirring music all the time. Finally came the voice of Adolf Hitler. The crowd on the sidewalk was deathly quiet. Der Führer spoke for 40 minutes. It had finished, and the rousing sound of Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil came through on the noisy loudspeaker. There was no mention of the new peace in any sentence. The Germans on the sidewalk around me were puzzled. Could it be that everybody in Germany knew that peace had arrived except Hitler? Had nobody told him?
Everyone always imagines, you see, that the Berliners and Germans were desperate for war. Well, the reality is slightly different. Berliners being very left, even after Chamberlain had gone on the radio to declare war, Berliners felt that this couldn't be true. And there was a rumour which had gone round Berlin that a late peace, was about to be negotiated, which is why they were queuing up outside radio shops in the hope that Hitler would say something that would convince them that a peace was on the way. So that they weren't the sort of, you know, war-mad nutters that we always imagined them to be.
And this is the view, obviously, of an American diplomat, but who also has a ringside seat. So he is watching this all unfold. I suppose as a writer who dealt extensively with Berlin, the way that's been your job as well.
I was always interested in the experience of the ordinary man in Berlin. It always puzzled me there were no kind of social histories of what it was like to be an ordinary Berliner during the Nazi period, during the war. And that was what I wanted to read. I didn't want to read sort of huge, great sort of magisterial histories about life in the bunker and sort of Mussolini coming for dinner and all that kind of thing. I wanted to sort of find out what it was like for ordinary people, and a lot of history is sort of concentrated on a minority who were persecuted, which is right and proper. But equally, very little of it has actually sort of concentrated on the majority of people who were German and what it was like for them. And that was the thing that fascinated me, was, you know, how they could live their lives while all of this was happening, and what it must have been like to sort of walk this kind of moral tightrope all the time.
And you have this great ambiguity, don't you? This difficult, lefty, proletarian, lots of it city, which had often voted for the left parties, suddenly finding themselves as the war capital, and it is the capital of the Reich.
Yes. Well, of course, I mean, except say Hitler very quickly left and sort of spent most of his time at the Berchtesgaden or the Wolf's Lair or somewhere else. So, I mean, the minute the first bombers arrived, he was out, really. So as a war capital, it's very much like London in a way, I suppose, because both our city and their city were at the heart of what was going on. The bombers... And just as London is a city where you walk around and see historic ghosts all the time, so is Berlin, but more so. When I go to Berlin, I hardly see the new buildings for looking for the old ones and seeing the ghosts of what was there. I had a rather curious experience. I had to take a party of Spanish journalists on a little tour of Berlin. The first thing they wanted to see was the site of Hitler's bunker, which is now a car park. So I was walking around this car park and saying, well, you see that BMW over there? Well, that was Hitler's bedroom. And they all immediately went over and took a picture of this BMW, actually.
Yes, some things changed beyond recognition. But as you say, ghosts in Berlin have a long literary resonance as well and have fascinated many people who are big writers in the present but have often dealt with the recent past. And I think I'm going to guess that your next writer might be John le Carré, who defines really the writing about Cold War Berlin and gives it his unmistakable presence. The Spy Who Came In From the Cold really did create the picture that many of us carry in our heads in Berlin as the city of watchtowers, spies and mutual misdoings by the great powers. And here we're going to hear from le Carré as he sets the scene for the defection of the spymaster Kahler in Smiley's People.
He had known Berlin when it was the world capital of the Cold War, when every crossing point from east to west had the tenseness of a major surgical operation. He remembered how, on nights like these, clusters of German policemen and Allied soldiers used to gather under the arc lights, stamping their feet, cursing the cold, fidgeting their rifles from shoulder to shoulder, puffing clouds of frosted breath into each other's faces. He remembered how the tanks waited, growling to keep their engines warm, their gun barrels picking targets on the other side, feigning strength. He remembered the sudden wail of the alarm klaxons and the dash to the Bernauerstrasse or wherever the latest escape attempt might be. He remembered the fire brigade ladders going up, the orders to shoot back, the orders not to. The dead, some of them agents. But after tonight, he knew that he would remember it only like this. So dark, you wanted to take a torch with you into the street. So still, you could have heard the cocking of a rifle from across the river.
Now, be honest, Philip, is every writer nowadays who writes about Berlin haunted by the presence of le Carré?
Oh, definitely. He's the master, without a shadow of a doubt. The first time I went to East Berlin, it was actually like being in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold myself. I am unashamedly one of these people who kind of laments the passing of the wall. It was one of the most exciting experiences a writer could have, was to walk into the East, to come up from the S-Bahn station at Friedrichstrasse and walk into this kind of wasteland. I mean, it was like the Soviet tanks had left, a couple of weeks before. Bullet holes in everything. And it's completely different now, of course. I mean, you come up from Friedrichstrasse S-Bahn station and the first thing you see is a sort of Versace shop, and the place is just a kind of shopper's paradise.
But one thing le Carré uses sedulously, really, throughout his work, is the theme of things not being quite as they seem. It's what keeps us on tenterhooks, and it's what drives his plots, but it's also what makes Berlin work, isn't it? Because everything has been something before.
Yes.
And it's like you say about the Friedrichstrasse, it's often been entirely different just a few years ago.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, the street names are the thing that really fox you if you're not careful. I mean, it's quite common to be on a street that's had, you know, maybe three or four different names. And there was a Hohenzollern name, which was, you know, got rid of by possibly even got rid of during the Spartacus time, then got changed under Weimar, then the Nazis changed it again. Budapest-Pesterstrasse became Hermann Göringstrasse, and now it's called something else. It was something else again. And so there's so many incarnations that Berlin's had. It's almost impossible to know where you are sometimes. You know, I've actually been in a taxi and asked to go to Budapest Strasse by mistake. And, you know, the guy sort of looked at me as, you know, as if I'm sort of much, should be much older than I am.
A top tip is never to ask for the main station because they keep moving it depending on where the four-power agreement was going at any time. The character Carla that we heard mentioned there is one of the greatest incarnations in Le Carré. Of course, he had a real East Berlin equivalent, didn't he, in Marcus Wolf, the spymaster who I worked with for a while when I was co-writing his memoirs. And he said he was absolutely haunted by this literary character because he said, well, it was him, but it wasn't him. And sometimes he was very proud of it, and sometimes he just wanted to push it away. Mm. The thing of turning things into literature, are you turning your experience of Berlin and your feeling into a detective? What crystallised that?
Well, I sort of didn't set out to be a detective writer or a crime writer because I got interested in German history and the life of ordinary Germans. That was really what I wanted to write about. Berlin was the thing I wanted to write about. And it was, because it was so, everything was so difficult to find out, like I was saying about the street names and how, for instance, Berliners don't particularly want to sort of describe what it was like, so there are not many books about it. It was kind of like being a detective myself. After a while, I thought, well, this is actually, it's a good idea that actually I write about a detective. And almost simultaneously, it came to me that, you know, that would create all sorts of opportunities to be morally ambiguous, because I'm not really, I don't really like writing about heroes, and I don't really believe in people who are just total heroes. It's much more interesting if you're a writer to write about people who have a dark side and who do things that they feel guilty about. And quite often, also for me, it was a way of exploring the question that I think we all ask ourselves sometimes, which is, what would I have done if I'd been in that situation? And kind of every book I've done about this, this has always been the question which has sort of been in front of me, which is, what would I have done if I'd seen a Jew being beaten up on the Kurfürstendamm? What would I have done if someone had said, you know, come with me to the Gestapo and tell me the truth about this person or we'll torture you? That's the question. And it's a very important question that I think it's important that we never stop asking ourselves, really.
I have to ask, given that you said you arrived and you first lived in the West, and then you took your first walk in the East, so are you by preference an Aussie or a Vessi? Which side would you have preferred, apart from the politics, which side would you have preferred to be on?
Well, now I'm a very definite Aussie, actually, because I have to confess, I always stay at the Adlon Hotel, which is just behind on the wrong side of the Brandenburg Gate, if you know
what
I mean.
That's being Eastern at a very high level, I think, actually.
I'm always fascinated whenever I look out the window, and I just, because I can't help but look at it and see, you know, a minefield and sort of barbed wire, and it's just the most staggering view. Now, I mean, if you're under 45, I think it's impossible to imagine what it was like. It seems such a ridiculous thing to do, to have a wall run right the way through the centre of a city.
Well, we'll move from the Cold War to the Berlin of underground music dens and all-night partying and those Berlin flat shares, which rarely had the same cast of characters for more than a few months. And here's the singer David Bowie talking about living in Berlin and leaving it.
I had not intended to leave Berlin. I just drifted away. Maybe I was getting better. It was an irreplaceable, unmissable experience and probably the happiest time in my life up until that point. Coco, Jim and I had so many great times. But I just can't express the feeling of freedom I felt there. Some days, the three of us would jump into the car and drive like crazy through East Germany and head down to the Black Forest, stopping off at any small village that caught our eye. Just go for days at a time. Or we'd take long all-afternoon lunches at the Wannsee on winter days. The place had a glass roof and was surrounded by trees and still exuded an atmosphere of the long-gone Berlin of the 20s. At night, we'd hang with the intellectuals and beats at the Exile restaurant in Kreuzberg. In the back, they had this smoky room with a billiard table, and it was sort of like another living room, except the company was always changing.
Would you have liked a night out with David Bowie in Berlin?
I don't think I could have kept up with his relentless nightlife. I think that's probably the best way to put it. I mean, the interesting thing about that piece, I think, is it illustrates what I was talking earlier, is Berlin's an idea. It's a city that seems to belong to the world. Everybody has an impression of Berlin before they go there. They have a Berlin that they've almost created for themselves in their minds. Interestingly, Bowie was no exception.
He also evokes the transience, doesn't he, of that comings and goings, which are quite normal in Berlin, and people don't seem to mind if you just disappear for a while and come back.
It's always been a city which has been attractive to immigrants. People are always coming and going in Berlin. It's that kind of itinerant city, really, and much the irritation of the genuine Berliners who live there, you know, who hate people like me, probably, you know, who come and write about their city without, you know, actually being a Berliner. But I think that's quite important, actually, is to sort of not be a Berliner and want to write about it. I don't think you have to be. I think it's a city that is almost written about better when it's written by strangers.
But I'm afraid that is where we have to leave it anyway, with the ghosts of Berlin all around us. And thank you very much to Philip Kerr and to our reader, Claire Higgins.
Today's Proms Literary Festival programme was presented by Anne McElvoy and produced by Natalie Steed. That was recorded earlier this evening across the road in the Royal College of Music and back here in the Royal Albert Hall. And live on BBC Radio 3, you join me, Andrew McGregor, and a capacity audience eagerly awaiting the second part of this evening's prom given by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra and its Liverpudlian chief conductor and artistic director, Sir Simon Rattle. That applause for the promenader's announcement of money raised in collections at the end of each concert in the season. Well, we heard Beethoven's Fourth Symphony in the first part, and the second opens in an eerily similar fashion, the mysterious mists of Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 1. You might have heard Simon Rattle talking earlier about the reasons he's programmed the two works together, those similar openings that both symphonies to some extent come out of the composer's love affairs, and especially the sense that they share a love of nature, showing feelings for the country rather than the city, as Rattle put it. Mahler had been infatuated with a young soprano at the Kassel Opera, where he was music director, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Johanna Richter. An unhappy affair for Mahler, pretty much a case of unrequited love, but the emotional inspiration for his Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen, the musical starting point for his first purely orchestral work on a symphonic scale. Mahler was careful to point out, though, that the symphony went far beyond the love story that inspired it. The external event was only the occasion for the work and not its content, he added. And anyway, by the time he was finishing his first symphony, he was in love again with Marion von Weber, the wife of the composer's grandson. It's easy to see how the sense of romantic despair that permeates the songs became a vital part of the symphony, with its themes of life, love, and nature. It started life with a title, The Titan, after a novel by one of Mahler's favourite German romantic writers, and a five-movement layout which he called a tone poem in symphonic form. And the original headings for the movements are evocative. Part one was titled From the Days of Youth, beginning with The Spring and No End to It. Part two became Commedia Humana. But after the first three performances, Mahler dropped the second movement, the title and the headings, so that when it was first performed by this orchestra, the Berlin Philharmonic, in 1896, it was simply billed as Mahler's Symphony No. 1 in D major. From sketches to published four-movement symphony had taken 14 years. Along the way, Mahler had expanded his orchestra, and as well as three offstage trumpets for the first movement's distant fanfares, he asks for the highly unusual number of seven horns. Why? Here's Simon Rattle.
There weren't originally seven horn parts in Mahler 1. He used quite a normal orchestra. Now, what is interesting is that Mahler made his orchestra for what he needed. And he realised that the first version simply wasn't going to work. And I think the truth is that he needed not only horns to play high together, but horns to play low together. So in a way, you have the basic thing of two hands instead of one hand. What's very interesting is that you often get three-part chords with the three lower horns and the other horns above, so that there is an extraordinary warmth. And also, he was knocked out by Wagner's orchestration, who just basically invented the modern orchestra, and he was damned if he wasn't going to use it. And he used more and more.
This evening's conductor, Simon Rattle, on Mahler's orchestration. And here he comes to conduct the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra in Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 1 in D major, which they first performed under the composer's guidance 114 years ago.
Thank you.
The triumphant ending of Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 1 in D major, with those seven horns told to play out even above the trumpets and standing as a section to make sure they did. 14 years in the making, that symphony, first performed for the composer in the four-movement form in which we just heard it by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra back in 1896, and brought to us by their 21st century successors with chief conductor Sir Simon Rattle. A performance greeted with probably the loudest cheer from the audience here in the Royal Albert Hall that I've heard all season. People standing all around me, leaping straight to their feet at the end of that performance. Here comes Rattle once again, asking for applause for the principal double bass soloist, whose muted solo began the Frere Jacques funeral march, Jana Saxela. Handshakes for the principal string players. Rattle going round them all in turn and walking into the orchestra to congratulate the other members and shake them warmly by the hand. All of them standing here now. And there's one soloist I should perhaps mention. Pretty special occasion for him, the principal clarinetist, to announce his presence as the cuckoo in the symphony's introduction. His name isn't even in the programme. Clarinetist Andreas Ottensheimer. I'm told he's very young, just 21 years old, and it's just about his first concert sitting principal clarinet in the Berlin Philharmonic, I was told in the interval. He's probably still pinching himself. Thundering of the promenader's heels as Simon Rattle comes back onto the platform. And that huge roar is for the principal horn player, Stefan Dohr. The entire horn section standing for the second time in just a few minutes. Trumpets and trombones now. And the two timpanists and three other percussionists that made such a tremendous racket at the end of the symphony. Rattle's gone over to flautist Emmanuel Pauwd and oboist Albrecht Meyer, and now the rest of the wind section on their feet as well. In rehearsal, Rattle told them all, it's a big hall, but you don't have to play louder. You have to play more beautifully, because you can hear everything in here. And couldn't you just? Even a pin dropping in some of the quieter moments, a breathless hush here in the hall. But it's the first time the Berlin Philharmonic's played Mahler 1 at the Proms, and with it they're ending this season's Mahler anniversary celebrations, even as they start their own Mahler cycle, as Simon Rattle was telling us earlier. Last year they brought with them two very different symphonies, Brahms and Shostakovich, as well as Wagner and Messiaen, and there's more Wagner from them in their second Prom tomorrow evening, the Prelude to Parsifal, after which they're joined by soprano Carita Matalifa, Richard Strauss's four last songs. And after those two great German late romantics, New Vienna beckons, music by Schoenberg and his students Berg and Webern. Rattle getting the entire Berlin Philharmonic back to its feet, embracing some of the members of the orchestra warmly, everyone he can reach, it seems. Don't forget to try the new experimental high-quality stream of Radio 3 at a higher bitrate. It launched earlier this evening. It'll be there until and including the last night of the Proms next Saturday. Why not try it out in tomorrow evening's Berlin Philharmonic Prom, beginning live at 7:30 here on Radio 3. Well, we've experienced life, love and nature packed into these two symphonies by Beethoven and Mahler, brought vividly to life for us by the Berlin Philharmonic. Forgive us all here at the hall for sounding as though we're full of the joys of spring. Back in Broadcasting House, in autumnal shades, here's Jonathan Swain.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Andrew McGregor there at the Royal Albert Hall. And as well as the BBC iPlayer for listening again right via the Radio 3 website, just to say there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom broadcast again on good old Steam Radio. That's here on BBC Radio 3, Monday afternoon, the 13th of September, starting at 2 o'clock. Monday afternoon, the 13th of September at 2 o'clock. Also, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's Prom, then just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on Share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer prom season, we'll be bringing you the Sir Henry Wood Proms novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, in a few minutes' time, our feature, A World Beyond Narnia. Louise Doughty explores the phenomenal growth of the young adult fiction market, which made over £50 million in the UK last year. That's at 9:45. Until then, Shostakovich for solo piano. He was a fine pianist himself. In 1927, he won a Certificate of Merit at the first Chopin International Piano Competition in Warsaw. And his set of 24 preludes are perhaps a tribute to Chopin, whose own 24 preludes work their way through all the keys. Shostakovich's set is from the early 1930s, written between his notorious Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk opera and his Concerto for Piano, Trumpet and Strings. In other words, Shostakovich just a year or two before the state condemnation that led to his Fifth Symphony. Well, a group of the preludes here, played by Olli Mustonen. Thank you. numbers 20 to 23 of the Shostakovich 24 Preludes, music the 20-something Shostakovich put the finishing touches to in 1933, just before he set to work on his concerto for piano, trumpet and strings. The pianist was Olli Mustonen. It's a quarter to ten. Well, now in this evening's feature, writer and broadcaster Louise Doughty explores the recent phenomenal growth in what's called young adult fiction, though it's a genre of far wider interest than that title suggests. Here she is with A World Beyond Narnia.
In the summer of 1974, I lay in the grass on a primary school playing field and pricked my finger with a needle, while my best friend lay in the grass beside me and did the same. We pressed our fingers together so the blood could mingle, closed our eyes and took a solemn oath. We would always believe that Narnia really existed. But then we went to secondary school. My best friend stopped believing in Narnia before I did. I was devastated by her betrayal, although somewhat comforted by the lines in the final Narnia book, where C.S. Lewis dismisses the feckless Susan, who also stopped believing, as being only interested in lipstick, nylons and invitations. According to the mores of the 1950s, when The Last Battle was published, Susan had leapt from childhood to adulthood. The teen years, after all, had only just been invented.
The BBC presents The Young Person, a guide to the life and opinions of the modern teenager.
I think the worst thing about being a teenager is the fatal indecision of your character.
You've got to try and sort out your ideas on life, your religion, your politics. There's so much to do, and in this modern world of ours, when things move so quickly, you've got to get it done quickly. You cannot waste time.
The trouble is with adolescence is that one is half a child and half a grown-up still, and you have bits. Sometimes you want to behave as an adult, and sometimes you still want to go a bit wild and behave in a childlike way.
Change the cut-glass accents, and the concerns of those 1950s interviewees sound very familiar. But one major difference is that teen culture was in its infancy, particularly in the world of books.
Well, I'm old enough not really to have had any specific teenage fiction, so I'm afraid I did the classic thing of moving into the classics, but of course it was a complete disaster. I mean, I got as far as The Red Room in Jane Eyre many times, but as a child, I really didn't understand what all that was about. So I read that and Dickens. Again, you know, Oliver Twist was absolutely fine, except I couldn't manage Nancy and Bill because I didn't understand all of that. So I think it's very interesting that those were thought of as books suitable for young people, but actually you needed quite a lot of maturity to understand what was going on.
The biggest influence on me, without a doubt, was Richmond Crompton and the William books. And I think I jumped from the Beano and William almost without a break into Jane Austen and grown-up novels. So I seem to have missed whatever there was for teenagers. Perhaps there wasn't anything for teenagers in my day. I mean, I'm very old, I'm 62.
Young adults today are so privileged compared to when I was young in the 50s. All you had to read, really, were the classics. But how much more powerful and empowering it is to be able to read things which are about young people like you, you know, where you can put yourself in their situation, or you can put yourself in an entirely different society and find out how that works.
The young adult fiction category goes beyond the teenage years, appealing to readers in their early 20s as well. And considering what a potentially large and lucrative market this is, it's perhaps surprising that it's taken so long to be consciously identified as such. Caroline Horn is children's books editor of The Bookseller.
Teen sales have risen dramatically in the last year by 89% to around £50 million. Pounds, which is an enormous increase for any genre, but in the young adult market it's particularly surprising because that market has always been there but never attracted the kind of interest that it is getting now. Yes, Stephanie Meyer has spearheaded the growth in that sector, but if you look behind the gothic, vampire, dead romance books, there are really many, many books that now appeal to young adults that publishers might not have been publishing 20 years ago.
An 89% increase is an impressive figure, especially when set against a 13% drop in sales of children's fiction during the same period. Over half of that increase was down to Stephanie Meyer's hugely popular vampire series, Twilight, but that still leaves another £26.4 million spent on other books for young adults. At a time when we are being told that the competing demands of television, the internet and the music industry are all teenagers are interested in, this is a colossal success story for the world of novels. Our story involves those competing demands, but is also about a new generation of committed writers and smart, omnivorous readers.
Teenagers are great to write for because they demand respect, so you absolutely have to respect them. But if you do, they will follow you anywhere. They're not snobs about genre, they're not snobs about how the story is told, they just want a good, thumping read that takes them seriously.
It's true that compared with the 1950s, the teen years have become a highly pressurised zone. Angela McRobbie is a sociologist specialising in literature and culture at Goldsmiths College, University of London.
Almost the whole of our society, our commercial society and consumer society, is fixated on teens. And so it's not really surprising that publishing and literature have joined this bandwagon. In some ways, actually, they might be rather late in joining that bandwagon.
Books for teens have arguably lagged far behind other aspects of teen culture, and, as with other teen-related matters, America led the way. Even before there were real teen books there, there were novels where the key focus was on the teen years, as young adult author Meg Rossoff recalls.
There was then what I think of as kind of emergence literature, which was what might now be published for teenagers, but in those days was actually published for adults. For instance, To Kill a Mockingbird or Catcher in the Rye, a guy called Chaim Potok who was writing about teenagers. And then, of course, you go on to adult literature. And my taste, even then, it's really odd when I think about it, was also for this emergence literature, the Age of Innocence. Even in Shakespeare, Henry IV is really almost a teen story.
And then came a breakthrough. Children and young adult book expert Julia Eccleshare.
The identification of a group which weren't children but weren't adults, this notion that there was kind of teen fiction and what it would be, I think began with Beverly Cleary's 15, which came from America. America was way ahead at that point. They were talking about teenagers. Teenagers were an entity in a way that we weren't here. And that happened in pop music as well. And at the same time, there were lots of books coming in from Scandinavia where they were talking about sex, which, again, wasn't happening in UK at all. And then I suppose the kind of two key titles, perhaps, are Forever by Judy Blume for sex, because that's the first book that had an explicit sexual moment. And, of course, the other classic teenage book was Melvyn Burgess's Junk, which did, as it were, for drugs, what Judy Blume had done for sex.
So where, I wondered, had all the readers of young adult fiction come from? Were they lying in wait after that last great explosion in young literature?
If you look at the demographics, probably the Harry Potter bulge has moved now into this age range. So in a sense, yes, there was some inevitability there. But I think more importantly than that sort of shift into crossover fiction, you know, that appeals to adults as well as younger readers, was very much the marketing issue. With Harry Potter, retailers and publishers realised that actually there was a lot of money to be made in children's books. And at the time that Harry Potter was coming through, you also had quite a revolution in how retailing of books was done. There was much more focus on book scan figures, so how many books sold in the first week, in the first month, in the first 3 months. A focus on bestsellers, because suddenly you could identify these books really clearly. So when something like Stephanie Meyer comes along, they've got the information at their fingertips that they need to see that this is a growing phenomenon. The interesting thing with Stephanie Meyer was she was huge in the US in the way that she hadn't really taken off in the UK. And the way she did take off was through word of mouth.
You use the expression word of mouth there, which is a bit of almost a prayer in the publishing industry, isn't it? That's what we're all after.
I wonder what that really means these days. I mean, I'm thinking when we were children, it meant you took a book to school and told your friend about it in geography, and she told her friend about it in the playground or in the biology class. But of course, nowadays, with the explosion of the internet, word of mouth means something quite different, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I mean, if you're looking at Harry Potter word of mouth, that's only going back 10 years ago, that was still playground. Children handing Harry Potter on and librarians finding out about it and booksellers finding out about it. And it was, again, only until the third book in the series that the media found out about it. And that was very much grassroots word of mouth from children themselves. Stephanie Meyer has definitely benefited from the internet, and everyone is gossiping about Twilight, what's happening with the films, where it's all going, who their favourite characters are. And, you know, you do get this huge groundswell. That's all online.
The people who've read Harry Potter love it because everybody else has read Harry Potter and they love the conversations around it as well as the experience of doing the reading. The people who are reading Twilight love it because everybody else is reading Twilight. And so in a sense, even though the actual experience of reading the book is very individual and particular and private, there is very quickly a community and a security around that. And I think that's quite important. I mean, I think for the readers it's quite important because they think, well, everybody else has read this stuff and they didn't think it was disgusting and they didn't think it was shocking and they thought it was all right to know about this or that or the other. I think that's fantastic. I think that's about a very powerful kind of reading.
Joy Court is head of the school's library service in Coventry. Like Julia, she's positive about this new convergence culture, although she's also keen to emphasise that the book is not just a passenger.
I think it's the films which have opened the doors to books. And I certainly think the film industry has captured the fact that children's young adult fiction has a quality of storytelling and a quality of imagination which they probably don't get in other novels, other areas. So there's a lot there to exploit. And I think that's why they're choosing to make films of these particular books. I mean, Philip Pullman made a great point when he won what was the Whitbread Prize with The Amber Spyglass about the fact that young adult children's novels are allowed to tell stories. And that's what a lot of adult writers don't do. They're self-consciously artistic or creative with their language and not necessarily hooking people into a story.
I think to really understand teenage fiction now, we have to think of it almost immediately in terms that are outside those of the written word. We've got to think of it in visual terms. We've got to think of it in terms of fashion and clothing and
vampires on pyjamas.
Precisely, absolutely.
I don't know about pyjamas, but there was no shortage of fashion and clothing merchandise at the recent Twilight convention in Birmingham. 900, mostly girls and young women, had paid to gather in a hotel for a weekend, attend various events, have their photos taken with some of the stars, and share their enthusiasm about these books, in which typical teenagers from our ordinary world interact, often romantically, with vampires who may look and talk like them, but whose habit of sinking their teeth into people's necks is combined with a whole range of supernatural powers. And the hero of Twilight, Edward, is not only superhuman, but madly in love with the passive, insecure Bella.
Bella, she doesn't think that she's all that great, which most girls have a lot of insecurities with stuff like that, because whenever you read the book, you picture yourself as Bella. And just, like, the love story, they can't stop it. It's just, like, chemical or something like that.
Yeah. It's just like what every girl would want to happen to them, even though things get in the way. You know, you just want to be her just so that you can have Edward, just because he's just like this perfect guy.
He's patient, he's like generous, but also later on in the book said that, I just want you to be happy, which is what literally every girl wants. It's just like a guy just wants her to be happy.
I love your necklace. I love those kind of gathered charm styles. They're pretty.
This is your first time been to England, have you come before?
It is, my very first trip.
Stephanie Meyer didn't make it to Birmingham, but she's far from the only vampire author on the scene. Richelle Mead's Vampire Academy series has sold 3 million copies in America alone, and if the number of fans waiting to have their books signed by her is anything to go by, she's now breaking into the British market too.
Are you having a good time here?
I am, yeah. It's my third one, so...
Your third?
Yeah, each year. I've been all of them. Thank you. I hope you have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Huge queues there, Michelle, enough to make even any bookseller smile, I think. How's the hand feeling?
You get used to it. It becomes part of the job. And I've done 2 or 3 hour signings, and you kind of toughen up to that. Once you start extending, though, the hand complains.
You've got a wonderful website, and you do a blog as well, which is amazing when you have such a tough schedule for producing books. Do you feel that that's part of this whole phenomenon?
The biggest thing, you know, that really powers teen fiction is word of mouth. And that will do more than any print ad could ever do. And the internet, you know, gosh, that's the way it's come about in the last 10 years, is a wonderful medium for getting the word out. And, you know, apart from my website and social networking, they have their own forums and they're talking about this and they're spreading the word. And people, you know, all around the world are talking about these books. And I do think it's important to them, and I think they feel connected with me.
They comment about what you're wearing, don't they? I saw some of the comments on your website. They're very sweet. They tell you that they like your zebra print shirt and things like that.
They do, and they recognize my wardrobe now, which makes me think I need to expand it. They'll say things like, oh, I wondered which dress you were going to wear.
Are you able to say, what is it about the whole vampire phenomenon that makes those young readers so passionate?
That's the million-dollar question. Nobody knows the answer. There's something exciting about a vampire, I think, because they're scary. They're a slight monster, but they're also very human in some ways. And so they can be relatable, but they're dangerous. And for teens, so many of these vampire characters are involved in romances. Also in my books, what I hear, the heroine is very strong, and girls are particularly drawn to that.
Richelle Mead's heroines are not so much in need of rescue as those in Twilight. Her main character, Rose, is part vampire herself and a passionately involved bodyguard to her full-blooded vampire best friend, Lyssa, whom she must protect at all cost. As the mother of daughters, I know which role model I prefer. Angela McRobbie.
Girls, at that point in their lives, their bodies and their minds are undergoing incredible changes. They're also, in today's world, they're thinking about losing their virginity at an increasingly young age. But they're also getting used to issues like menstruation, how to deal with that, the simple visual appearance of blood in their lives. And I think that the popularity of the vampire is that it sort of plugs into a whole world of incredibly intense anxieties and fears and thrills and also excitements. And there's a sense in which the idea of the vampire and, you know, turning into some different kind of species altogether is very close to the kind of psychology of teenage femininity, because so much emphasis is put from the wider world on adhering to certain kind of norms of appearance and behaviour. And I think there is in the lives of teenage girls some incredible desire to escape from high school culture. So I think the fascination with the vampire is a little bit like the fascination for the Gothic novel in the 19th century, that there is a kind of desperate desire to somehow just break out of those conventions.
One of the strands we've been looking at in the books we've been discussing in this programme is, in a way, a sort of offshoot of that idea. I mean, obviously, what's first and foremost in many of these books that have been successful is plot. But running parallel with that, there does seem to be a running theme of a lot of the young people in the books actually behaving heroically in a way that teens don't have the opportunity to do in real life. A lot of them are very socially responsible. A lot of them have to save other people. They have to save the life of their girlfriend, as in Patrick Ness, or they have to save their best friend, as in Richelle Mead's vampire series. Do you think maybe we don't give teenagers enough opportunity to behave heroically? Is that where that interest comes from?
I would say that where there is an increasing emphasis on individualization, particularly in magazine culture, and where there is an emphasis on, particularly for girls, on only thinking about self and being the perfect kind of would-be Paris Hilton, I would say actually in the everyday life of teenagers, there are these kind of passionate attachments to each other, and friendship has always been a part of not just girls and women's literature, but also literature per se. And in complex literature, there is the possibility of exploring a much wider range of emotions and a much wider range of ethical choices
that go far beyond the rather bland and the rather one-dimensional romantic dilemmas that one sees often in television soap operas or in other forms of entertainment.
Although supernatural or adventure novels tackle issues of friendship or heroism, teen love, in a more conventional sense, is the staple subject matter of many young adult books. There's a whole category of very, very pink-looking books out there, which can only be described as junior chick lit. In his forthcoming book, Rich and Mad, William Nicholson takes a more intelligent and wide-ranging approach to exploring the subject of girl-boy relations, including the tricky area of first sex, in his case, between teenagers Richard and Maddie.
I was remembering my own teenage years, and I remember the fear that I lived in all the time of inadequacy, and particularly a sense of uselessness in relation to girls. Terror that this thing that I wanted most in the world, to be loved by a girl, I would never get, because I was not lovable or not sexy, which is a different thing. You know, I knew my mother loved me, but I couldn't imagine a girl loving me, particularly a girl who was attractive, who I desired. So I then thought, I want to write about what it feels like from the girl's point of view and the boy's point of view to bring out all their fears and longings and stupidities and mistakes. And I wanted to explore that and lead it towards the intense emotional, passionate delight that happened to me with my first sexual experience. And I'm not hearing about that. I'm hearing about sexualization of teens. I'm hearing about pornography. I'm hearing about people getting drunk and getting pregnant in cupboards. Where is anybody talking about how sex is the most powerful emotional moment ever? It horrifies me. And this is because we have completely surrendered this territory to the pornographers. I think what perhaps a lot of people don't realise is that the vast majority of teenagers have access to the internet and they use it to watch internet pornography. The couple of surveys seem to imply that it's something like 80% of boys and about 60% of girls. I mean, really, really enormous figures. I've done my own asking around, and in that respect, it's been 100%. And the girls don't much like it, as far as I can tell, but they still want to know what the boys are looking at. The boys really like it.
I think that's a very interesting argument, because I think certainly as a woman and as a mother of two young daughters, I'm deeply, deeply concerned that the boys that they're going to be going out with eventually are being raised on this diet of pornography and are learning that that's how they treat girls and women, that's how girls and women behave. I mean, any parent, I think, has to be very, very anxious about that. Is there a sense in which your book, Rich and Mad, is not only a riposte to that, but also perhaps slightly a riposte to the kind of the Melvin Burgess, I'm thinking of doing it, you know, books which implied that somehow teenagers are very graphic and very lustful in themselves and just want sex and there isn't an emotional content? I mean, your book is very, very much about the emotional content behind sex.
I wouldn't say it's a riposte to Melvin Burgess. I think Melvin Burgess is a terrific writer. I have huge admiration for him, and I think that what he wrote in Doing It is true, and I think this is frightening and shocking to a lot of people. What I do want to do, though, is to say that that's not the whole story.
Boys really do need to discover about their emotions. I think that's what's so powerful about the William Nicholson, Rich and Mad, the new book that's coming out, because he's looking at emotions and love. I mean, he is dealing with sex, and it is something I'm going to have to warn my Catholic schools about, not in a sense of don't, but be careful who you give it to and aim it maybe at your sixth formers.
I wondered if there were any subjects Joy Court would not be happy to see covered in young adult fiction.
We had an event in Coventry last week with Gemma Malley, and a teenager in the audience actually asked her that question as a writer: are there any issues which you wouldn't deal with in a book? And she gave an absolutely fascinating response. Basically, she was saying no, and it's because she thinks teenagers are actually much tougher than we give them credit for, in that they can think the hard things and they are prepared to be very definite in their views. I think the teenage years are when you decide what you believe about society and politics and emotions and people, and you're learning all those things. Whereas she was saying, when you become a mother, for example, there's certain things you just can't read without being, you know, totally swept away in emotions. So she was saying that she thought teenagers were the ideal audience to be given challenging subjects and to be made to think about important things and about how the world works and about how people work.
That's very interesting, because I think most people who would encounter your job would imagine that you had some sort of gatekeeper role in terms of, oh, you know, we mustn't let our young adults or our teenagers be exposed to this, we must protect them from that. But it sounds to me that in actual fact what you do is the opposite. You're an enthusiast and you want the teenagers to be omnivores like you are and to read as broadly and as openly as they can.
I genuinely believe that's what the teenage years are for. But I would insist that my role is as a gatekeeper, because I do have very firm lines on quality. So I have no objections to bad language, sex, drugs, rock and roll, the whole thing, if it's within context and if the characters within the book have consequences arising from their action, because that's what happens in real life.
On the morning she was to be married, Pell Ridley crept up from her bed in the dark, kissed her sisters goodbye, fetched Jack in from the wind and rain on the heath, and told him they were leaving. Not that he was likely to offer any objections, being a horse. There wasn't much to take. Bread and cheese and a bottle of ale, a clean apron, a rope for Jack, and a book belonging to Mam with pictures of birds drawn in soft pencil, which no one ever looked at but her. The dress in which she was to be married she left untouched, spread over a dusty chair. She felt carefully inside the best teapot for the coins put away for her dowry, slipped the rope round Jack's neck, and turned to go.
The Bride's Farewell is the fourth novel from one of our leading young adult authors, Meg Rossoff, whose first book, How I Live Now, arguably broke new boundaries in what might be called crossover writing, intelligent novels that could be read as adventures by young people, but with a great deal to say to adults as well. Her new book is no different, in that although Pell sets off on a picaresque journey across 19th century rural England in flight from marriage, she also discovers that the world of adult responsibility is not so easily cast aside.
I loved the idea that she thinks she can leave and leave everything behind, but her family trails behind her like a kind of string of old tin cans on a just-married car. You know, she wants to leave everything behind, but they kind of come with her in a way, and that sense of responsibility. And it also, it's about the ties of love. You crave lightness, but in fact, you know, what weighs you down in the world and what gives your life meaning is connections.
It strikes me that it is one of the most difficult things for teenagers and young adults to learn, the idea that being adult isn't about having total freedom. I know certainly my 13-year-old can't wait to be adult because she thinks it means you can do whatever you want.
You get a credit card and you can go to Topshop and buy everything you like.
And a lot of the authors we've been speaking to have talked about this idea of how books like this can be a guide to the greyer areas of adulthood. You know, we pack children off from the certainties of childhood into this kind of weird no man's land of kind of adolescent and being a teenager. And novels can talk about how things are a lot more ambiguous when you're an adult. Was that something you were consciously aware of doing?
Yes, I think it is something I'm very consciously aware of doing, because I think of the journey of adolescence. And again, when I say adolescence, I mean, to me, it can start at 8 or 9 or 10 and really go all the way through your life. And I sometimes sort of think about adolescence as almost a metaphor for the journey of life. So, yes, so I think of the journey as a move from a kind of protected world where somebody is giving you the rules all the time in school, your parents, all that, into a world where there's a terrible lack of clarity. You know, what is love? What is responsibility? What does it mean to be an adult? What does it mean to be a friend? You know, what does it mean to be a lover? All those kinds of things are something that you desperately want to learn about and desperately need to learn about in order to be a so-called adult, as if that's a kind of a landing stage, which of course it isn't. It's an endlessly developing state of being.
And I know there's a lot of criticism about fiction for teens and young adults at the moment on the basis of either sexual explicitness or language or use of drugs. But it does seem to me that in a way, potentially, what was available in previous years was a lot more damaging. Girls would go straight from Anne of Green Gables into a Harlequin or Silhouette romances. They'd be reading something like Mills and Boone because the language was simple, the narrative was simple, there wasn't a huge amount of teen fiction. The boys might have fantasy.